What got you interested in first Everest and then specifically Mallory?
Well, I was traveling with a good friend of mine, Daniel Taylor. Daniel and I were on the east face of Everest in the Gamma Valley trying to photograph snow leopards and clouded leopards. And we got unusual snow conditions and we spent a lot of time in tents. And Daniel began to speak about these sort of Englishmen dressed in tweeds who read Shakespeare to each other at 23,000 feet, and I just became enamored of the story. And you know, from the very start, and of course, the dramatic part of the story that most people would be familiar with is that on June 8th, 1924, in the third attempt to climb Everest, Sandy Irvin, 22, and George Mallory, 37, were famously seen by Noah O'Dell cresting the northeast ridge, reputedly moving strong for the summit, when the mist rolled in and enveloped their memory and myth. And I was never interested in the question, did he get to the top or not? I mean, I was, but that wasn't the essence of what interested me. I wanted to know who these men were in 1920. And it struck me that, and I don't know quite how I got this idea, but from the very start, knowing the history of that war and being an Anglophile and you know, literally of having had schoolmasters as a kid who'd fought at the Somme, you know, I knew from the class and the age of these men they had to have gone through the fire of the war, and I knew they would have seen so much of death that it could have, in a sense, hold no more mystery for them. There's nothing more death could teach them except their own. I didn't mean to suggest they were cavalier about death, but they were prepared to accept a level of risk that might have been unimaginable before the war, because for them, life mattered less than the moments of being alive. That was from the very beginning my intuition about this. And so in order to pursue that, I wanted to find out what had happened to each of the 26 men who went to Everest in those three expeditions during the war. And, you know, it was famously said of both the Battle of Passchendaele and the Somme that the British Army lacked the clerk power to tabulate the dead. But if that was the case, they kept records of just about everything else. It was the most thoroughly documented war in history. And it also was remarkably compressed. I mean, the British zone of operations was never bigger than the English county of Lincolnshire. I mean, the British front was never longer than 125 miles. For much of the war, it was 85 miles. Behind that front, they built 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. You know, the Ypres salient, where 1.7 million boys died, could be walked around in a long day. It was 4 miles by 12 miles. And because so many millions of men poured through that zone of operation, and because after the war there was a sort of flood of memoirs and diaries and reflections and poetry and prose, literally it was possible not only to find out where each man was every day of the war virtually, with some notable gaps, but also it was easy to sort of ascertain, not easy, but with research it was possible to ascertain more or less and with some confidence what they had been exposed to at any point in time in their wartime experience. And that's what allowed me to sort of place them with a specificity in both time and space that I never would have thought it possible at the outset of the project.
So much of this, of the desire to climb the mountain, seems to have come from the horror of the war and the tour.
Well,
what's he talking about? But
I was very careful in this book not to editorialize and say that X led to Y. You know, I just wanted to explain who these men were, and there was no way of excluding what, by any definition, would have been their seminal experience of their lives. You know, the effort to climb Everest, of course, began long before the war as a kind of a gesture of imperial redemption for an empire of explorers that had lost the race to the North and South Poles, and suddenly you had Everest, the third pole, within the domain of the British Raj. It was a natural focal point of imperial ambitions. I think it's fair to say that in the wake of the war, it became a gesture of regeneration for a nation that had been bled white by war. The World War changed everything. It created everything we think of as being modern. And another important point is that we tend to think that this sort of stultified era of the Victorians somehow morphed into the chaotic wonder of the jazz era, you know, of the 20s. But we forget that the first decade of the 20th century was a very special period in which young people reacted against the restrictions of Victorian era and embraced a whole new philosophy of life that was very liberating. I mean, all that mattered to people like Mallory and his peers in the Bloomsbury set and the neo-pagans of Rupert Brooke was authenticity, transparency, beauty, affection, truth. They had a rock-solid dedication to those principles, and they wanted to live their lives freely, transparently, and authentically.
Someone asked him, why climb a mountain? And his flippant answer was,
because it's there.
Which is the enduring legacy.
Well, it's classic, because you know, he was on a lecture tour in New York in 1923, and he was asked that by a journalist, by someone at the end of a lecture, and one of his companion said it was just Mallory who famously didn't suffer fools. It was his flippant way to get rid of a bore so he'd get to a speakeasy and have a drink after a long lecture. But curiously, he later, you know, took that remark, which was published immediately in the New York papers, and did explain it with more profundity. And it caught on and was sort of engraved on, you know, at the chapel of many schools in Britain, because at some level it did distill a certain sense of a transcendent sense of why someone would do this. You know,
the book is Into the Silence: The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. I've been speaking with the author Wade Davis, and Into the Silence, published by Knopf Canada.